So I have prepared a brief statement, just picking up on for today, just picking up on a couple of matters, particularly around some additional comments and the evidence of Ms. McLeod from Transpower, which presented to you a couple of weeks ago.
So your comments on Transpower, are they within scope? Is Port New Zealand
submitted? Yes, and they had further submitted on some of Port New Zealand's submissions.
Okay.
And also I'm commenting on them wanting you to make changes that are not as a result of any submissions at all. But just as a summary, the focus of my evidence really is around the place of the FMU process and wanting to make sure that that process is clearly defined in that plan. That's paragraph 4 of my summary. I mention here, Commissioner Rodway has mentioned about the water allocation issue, and I've made a comment here about Objective 11, which is refers to that efficiency, and I think that we need the objective, the definition, so that it's clear what we're talking about in terms of efficiency. Particularly want to just make a comment about policy 39A that seeks that a consent application considers integrated management. In my opinion, such a requirement is only reasonable as integrated management is a catchment-wide issue and it's difficult for a single consent applicant to assess such catchment-wide issues in an application. And I base that on recent outcomes in the Horizon 1 plan that have identified that the requirement to consider the cumulative effects of the catchment means that it is problematic for any consent applicant to have access to the information required to undertake a catchment-wide assessment in respect of a single consent application. I see a similar situation would arise in the application of Policy 39A in Southland. The extent and scope of the information necessary to undertake such an evaluation places an unreasonable and potentially impossible hurdle in the consent process for the applicant. I consider it's the role of the plan and the FMU process to provide the context for integrated management when establishing the requirements for consent applications. So if you incorporate integrated management in your plan and that's what the consent application is addressing, that's fine. But if you ask them to look at how does integrated management fit into their consent application, that's a huge hurdle in terms of undertaking an AEE. Just a quick comment about Rule 9, discharges of agrochemicals, because it's dependent on Appendix D, but the 42A report is potentially recommending that Appendix D could be deleted. And I'm also conscious of recent changes to the regulation for managing hazardous substances, including agrochemicals at the national level, which does confuse this space quite somewhat. So whereas all hazardous substances were managed by the EPA under HAZNO, now Class 1 to 8 substances that are in the workplace are now managed separately by WorkSafe under the health and safety legislation. And the Class 9 ecotoxic substances, and that's probably the ones accountants are more interested in, and those Class 1 to 8s that aren't used in the workplace, such as a home or something, they remain under the control of the EPA, who are going to issue new control notices for Class 9 substances by the end of the year, I think. Therefore, I just want to raise the issue that Council needs to be mindful of any requirements in the plan that are dependent on HAZNO, as the situation is quite currently uncertain about what controls may be applied. And I also think, given the potential for adverse effects from the application of agrochemicals to water, I support a requirement for adequate training of users so that they have a clear understanding of means to ensure that adverse effects do not occur. And we have had growers in the past who've had crops damaged because someone's applied to water, it's gone downstream, they picked up the water, been irrigated on their crops, and it causes damage. So it's a very real issue for horticulture that anyone applying agrochemicals specifically to water actually know what they're doing, and really training's the way to ensure that that happens. Just a brief comment on Rule 25, that both Mr. Barber and I have commented on that. I'm particularly concerned about vegetable growers who cultivate on a regular basis, because I think one of the conditions is that you are not to cultivate more than there's a time limitation on it. No vegetable grower is going to be able to meet that limitation. We've heard our grower talking about how their cultivation practices work, which automatically throws them into a consent territory for cultivation. Now, the view of Horticulture New Zealand is if they're adopting the best management practices set out in that code of practice for erosion and sediment control of cultivated land, then that limitation about the number of times in a year or 2 years isn't necessarily an appropriate condition for the type of operation they're doing if they're complying with the code of practice. And therefore, we really want to use that code of practice as a permitted activity condition. I filed rebuttal evidence on the evidence of Mr. Hanson.
Yep, thank you.
And just really concerned about the definitions that are sought, because some of them aren't really appropriate for horticulture. We've had problems with this elsewhere in New Zealand, where there aren't people, certified nutrient management advisors, who are, have horticulture experience. And there's very few in New Zealand, so therefore having a limitation and a definition as sought by fertiliser companies places a very onerous burden on horticultural growers. In terms of the evidence of Ms. McLeod, I've read the evidence and considered the strike-through changes that she sought. I'm concerned about the changes that are being sought, as Ms. McLeod acknowledges they may be out of scope, but she considers they're necessary for the plan to give effect to the National Policy Statement for Electricity Transmission. And just by way of comment, Horticulture New Zealand has been very involved with Transpower in a range of hearing plan processes around the country on electricity lines, most of it usually at the district plan level, but we have recently been involved in discussions on the Otago RPS. So very familiar with both the National Policy Statement, the NZECP, the Code of Practice, and the range of provisions that Transpower are seeking. So it's against that background of knowledge, I suppose, that I make these comments. I'm concerned that submitters have not had the opportunity to submit or comment on the changes that Transpower are now seeking through the hearing process. I note that Transpower did not make a submission on the plan, and they're relying on the scope of further submissions for the changes that they are seeking. Transpower considers that a number of changes are necessary to give effect to the NPS. So they seek to add to policy 30 that the activity does not compromise the ability to operate, maintain, develop and upgrade the national grid. That seems to be beyond the scope of what their submission was. They're also seeking that NZECP be added as a condition to a number of rules. NZECP is a regulation which growers who've got transmission lines through their properties have to comply with anyway. So you begin to wonder why it's necessary for it to be added as a condition in a regional plan. Paragraph 31, the evidence does not set out why it's considered that these changes are necessary to give effect to the NPS other than they are linked to third-party activities that could compromise the national grid and so not give effect to policy 10 of the NPS. There's been limited ability for submitters to submit on whether the application of these provisions would affect third-party activities such as drainage management. This approach precludes natural justice for parties to be involved in discussions about what are appropriate provisions that would limit third-party activities. In addition, Transpower is seeking changes to a number of provisions which they made further submissions, but the changes sought to go beyond the scope of the original submissions, particularly around submissions on NZTA, which sought changes to Rule 51 and 59, but now Transparent, rather than something does not affect the network utility, Transpower are actually seeking the application of a 12-metre setback from the network utility, which from the evidence of Ms. McLeod seems to be based on NZECP. But NZECP has a range of setback distances, and it depends on the type of structure. Is it a pole? Is it a pylon? What's the span length? What's the voltage of the electricity going through the conductor? So there's no blanket 12-metre setback in NZECP. It will vary from span to span. And I consider that the setback required goes considerably beyond the submissions of NZTA. So I just wanted to highlight with you that Horticulture New Zealand is very concerned about the approach that has emerged through the hearing process. In terms of the horticulture wash water rule, Ms. Halliday's outlined the background and where we've got to in terms of the recent work. And what I've done in paragraph 50, I've set out the changes that we would potentially look at for that rule to include the code of practice, and also around the ponding or the field capacity issue, as we talked about in terms of the nitrogen level. So happy to take questions on that and my evidence in chief and my rebuttal evidence.
Yeah, thanks for that. Have you had a chance to listen to the audio recording of when Transpower came and spoke to us?
Yes, I have.
So you may have noticed that I asked Transpower at that time whether or not the requirements of NZECP needed to be complied with quite independently of this plan, and they said yes, they did need to be. And then I asked them about the point of duplicating that in the plan. So all I wanted to let you know is that we're aware of the issue that you've raised, and maybe our questions might give you an indication of our thinking on that.
Mm.
In terms of your...
Could I just comment on that? Transpower have...
No, I'd invite a comment from you. That was just me commenting to you. So now we'll see if we have questions for you on either your primary evidence or your rebuttal evidence. Lloyd, start with you.
Hi, Mr. Chairman. I'm having no questions for me.
Edward?
You're just you're dealing with your rebuttal evidence. I notice you haven't commented. I think it was Ngaitahu's rebuttal of your submission on policy 2 in the original submission. Did you have it?
I didn't include that in my rebuttal, but I did include it in my evidence in chief in terms of that policy about the iwi management plans.
Yes.
Yes. So that was objective 4, is it?
Policy 2. Was
policy 2.
Submission on policy 2. I don't think it's in the.
Yes. In my evidence in chief at 5.3.
So you're relying on that?
So the concern there is that to what extent should an individual applicant have to consider an iwi management plan? The RPS doesn't require it, the RMA doesn't require it. The RMA and the RPS require the council to give consideration to iwi management plans. And so what I'm saying in my evidence is, if those iwi management plans have been incorporated into the plans as required, why should an individual applicant also have to consider those iwi management plans? Not saying they're not important, it's just what level of threshold should an applicant have to demonstrate in relation to iwi management plans.
Mm-hmm.
So when you were doing the evidence, had you referred to the Ngaitahi rebuttal?
No, I'm sorry. I think I looked at it, but I didn't. I haven't rebutted it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Morris, any further questions?
No, we have to think about the changes you want for application of horticultural wash water when soil is saturated in relation to the amount of nitrogen that's in the discharge. Miss Halliday talked about this before as well. And most of your land that you use is oxidising, I imagine, and fairly free draining. So even 2 or 6 milligrams per litre or grams per cubic metre is probably higher than the groundwater in a lot of places. 6 would be anyway. So if you're applying it when it's wet and cold, that nitrogen's going to go straight through rather than be utilised.
So if we have a bore that the environment south and regularly check, and that runs at 11.
Yeah, that's a lot higher than normal, though, isn't it? Okay, all right, now just thinking out loud there, really, inviting any comment.
So the condition was, except where the nitrogen contains less nitrogen than the level in the receiving environment, so you're not adding to it, increasing it.
But that's already over a standard, then there could be a problem.
Mm. The other option is to apply policy that it complies with policy 15, which basically sets some benchmarks in terms of the discharge, that it meets the drinking water standard if it's going to an aquifer, which is 11 parts per million.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Paragraph 6.63 of the primary evidence. Mm. So your recommendation there, when I read that, I thought that's helpful because it's narrowing down the content of the code, which would be a relevant consideration. I just want to check, in light of your earlier comments about the changes to the has no legislation, etc., are you still recommending this to us?
Absolutely. Okay. In fact, I think we're better to put has no aside and just rely on the NZS Aquifer I9, which is certain and has been accepted by HASNO as an approved code of practice.
Okay, that's good. Just yes is good.
Sorry.
That's all right.
And just to say, those sections have been developed over a number of years with councils as what are the most appropriate ones.
Yeah. Just a comment for you on your paragraph 7.8, which relates to policy 20. Have you seen the track changes version from the officers dated 26th of May, where they've made some further recommendations to us based on our questions to them at the start of the hearing?
That was just in the last few weeks.
It came out on the 26th of May. Doesn't matter if you haven't.
I have.
Okay, well, in that version, it's on the web page, and you might be interested to look at that. But the staff are now recommending to us a reference to reliability of supplies included in policy 20, clause 1G.
Okay.
So they're now recommending that we do that, just for your information. The next question comes from paragraph 7.23. I just want to ask some more questions about your recommendation regarding efficiency. And it's 3 LUMs, economic, technical, and dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you said, and that's certainly my understanding, technical efficiency is all about reasonable use or crop modelling, etc., and that's fine. And this plan does that. Dynamic efficiency is about enabling transfers so that it can go to the best use, I think, without checking that the plan does that. Economic efficiency, though, is all about allocation and allocating water to nominally the most desirable use, which this plan doesn't do. Unlike the Waitaki Water Allocation Plan, which is one of the few plans in the country that does do that, this plan just follows the RMA convention as through case law of first and best dress. So I just really want to query you about, understand technical and dynamic efficiency being relevant, but I don't see the relevance of economic efficiency, and so I'd need persuading that that should be referred to in the plan, notwithstanding the fact that the NPS again does refer to it.
I suppose what we're trying to get councils to get their head around is that there is a place to consider that economic efficiency, and the highest value use or highest production per unit of water used actually is something that going forward, rather than that first and first serve approach, is something that is a valuable consideration.
So it's more for the FMU process to follow?
Yes.
Isn't it? And that would have to be consistent with the NPS FM anyway, yeah. Wouldn't it?
Yes.
Okay. And that was all the questions I had for the primary evidence. I had no questions from the rebuttal evidence, but thank you for putting that in. I'll just quickly check any questions for the rebuttal evidence. No, that's all the questions we had, I think.
Thank you.
So we look forward to that further revision of the code of practice that you tabled today. Mm-hmm. And if you could take into account those comments I made to you, that would be very helpful.
Yes. We will do.
And if anyone looking over in the next day or so comes back with any other comments, could you flick them through and we'll bring them in for that?
Sure.
Can we just say finally that we would like to invite councillors and the panel, if you would like to visit a growing operation, we're more than happy to facilitate that to help understand the growing system in Southland.
And I thank you very much for that. We've done a 4-day site visit of the region.
Okay.
And from our work in this region and other regions, we're very familiar with horticultural growing operations. A number of us have spent many days walking around horticultural growing operations in other areas, and I presume they're very similar down here. But we have looked at some of them on our 4-day site visit as well.
Great.
Not
okay.
From the road, we haven't gone into the property.
Okay.
It's been pretty helpful. So thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Sorry that we were delayed getting here.
That's all right, it's not your fault, it's fine. Just want to check, have Grant or Rachel Cope been arrived?
No.
Okay, we're now going to adjourn until 1 p.m. Thank you.